It's thinking like that that's going to get us killed.
Are you still dreaming of Daphne? She shakes her head. There have been no dreams since she decided to return to Fenburn. It is that, as much as anything, that tells her she is on the right track. Have you started to dream?
No,
Mirabella replies. She is still speaking only to you. She crosses her arms and nods to Billy as he approaches from the other side of the rail.
So you know, this is probably a trap. She is probably going to deliver us right into our little sister's clutches.
Have a little faith,
Arsinoe says as Mirabella walks away.
Two queens die. That is just how it is.
Don't say that,
Arsinoe calls after her, then turns back to the rail and pounds it with her fist.
Why does she say that?
I think she was joking. Billy leans against the rail. He shells a nut and holds it out.
No, thank you.
Where did you get those?
The captain had them. We paid him so much for an afternoon sail that I think he feels he should provide refreshments.
You're in a fine mood. Aren't you going to lecture me too?
He shrugs.
I trust Mirabella to take care of that. She'll make a very fine sister-in-law one day. Keep you in line for me.
Arsinoe scoffs. Then she slides her fingers into the hair at his temple. It is longer now than when they first met, long enough to blow in the strong sea wind. He called her his fiancée when they arranged for the boat. Only a lie, she knew, but it still gave her a pleasurable burst of excitement in the pit of her stomach.
I'm sorry for dragging you into this. Dragging you away from your mother and sister?
Don't be. I told them I was returning to find my father and bring him home. They couldn't have been more thrilled.
He smiles, perhaps a little bitter.
But it is dangerous, Arsinoe, and you're a fool for trying to do it alone.
Dangerous.
She curls her lip.
Fenburn is dangerous. You can't deny that. Not after what we've lost.
It's just as safe on the island as it is back there.
She jerks her head toward the mainland.
You can't be comparing the two. We don't force our girls to compete to the death.
Maybe not. But if I stayed there without you looking out for me, I might be killed. Girls like me must be killed there every day.
Arsinoe.
Maybe not executed, but dead anyway. Somewhere right now, a girl like me is being locked away to be forgotten about, or thrown onto the streets to starve. Pushed down so far that no one will care what happens to her.
She swallows.
I'd rather have Katarine's knife in my back.
Billy blinks and pushes himself up off the railing.
I don't know how we're supposed to make a future there, with you feeling that way.
I don't mean that I can't.
She stops. There is danger in both places, danger everywhere. But on the sea, sailing for the island, it feels like sailing home.
Maybe I'm just a part of the island, and you're just a part of the mainland.
They stand together, shocked. She wishes she could take it back. But even if she did, it would still be true. He threads his fingers through hers.
What if we were somewhere else, then?
Somewhere else?
Somewhere else entirely. If you could pass through the mist and be somewhere new, where would you want to go?
She has to think only a moment.
Sentra.
Sentra. Good. I've heard it's lovely, and I've never been there. We could sail there after this business is finished. After my father returns and we're no longer in danger of losing the estate, we could go to Sentra and be entirely new.
Arsinoe smiles.
That sounds nice. It reminds me of what Joseph used to say to me and Jules, about our happy ending.
Even though this is not the same ship, her eyes go to that place on the deck where Joseph lay dead in Jules's arms. She can still almost see him, that pale shape, the blood so washed away by seawater that it made it even harder to believe he was gone. Jules on my queen's guard, and him on my council. She wraps her arms around Billy and holds him tight. Over his shoulder, the sky is still clear, but it will not be long before they reach the mist. The Black Cottage. Jules, Kara, and Amelia stand at the front windows of the Black Cottage, watching Mathilde stare into the small fire she has built on the ground. The first snow fell that morning. Clearing out the skies, Mathilde said, making it a good night for visions. A good night to see their way ahead, now that they are leaving to continue their journey. "Where's Willa?" Jules asks. "In with Fen?" "Probably," Kara replies. "She does love that baby. More than that, though, she dislikes the sight gift. Having an oracle here makes her uneasy." In the yard, the fire melts the young snow in an even circle, and Mathilde crouches on toes and knees and the tips of her fingers. Sometimes it seems that she speaks to the flames, other times that she sings. They cannot hear her through the glass or see what it is that she sees. To Jules, Kara, and Amelia, the flames are only flames. "You are sure you will be all right?" Amelia asks. "You too with the little one, until Jules's mother returns?" "I should think so. We're both midwives." Amelia rolls her shoulder, favoring a bruise that Jules gave her as they practiced swordcraft with the thick sticks as the snow fell all around them. Kara reaches down and slaps her brown hound on the rump. "Let's get into the kitchen and start the stew for dinner. And I would speak to my niece a moment." Amelia nudges Jules. "Go. I am going into the woods after grouse. You could send some my way, if your gift reaches that far." She grins, but it changes quickly to a frown. "On second thought, don't. I can't shoot them when they come hopping into my lap." "Why don't you take Camden? She could use the run." Amelia nods. Her dark hair is loose and rumpled. It looks as restless and ready to be off as the rest of her. "Fine, but make something delicious. It won't be much longer that I will be able to get a meal from you, my queen." "Stop calling me that," Amelia swats her playfully. "I think you are starting to like it." Out by the fire, Mathilde blows into the smoke and feeds the flames with herbs and blue burning amber. She shakes her hair back off her shoulders, the braid of white, stiff and separate in the cold evening air. In the kitchen, Kara tears a large fillet of smoked fish into pieces. "Dinner tonight, courtesy of Braddock." "Oh, he caught it just for us, did he?" Kara snorts. "No. And to be honest, it is starting to be harder to get it away from him." She gestures to the counter, and Jules sets to chopping vegetables. "How long do you think it will be until Madrigal returns?" Jules asks. Kara's only response is a gentle raising of eyebrows. "Will you go in the larder for butter and cream?" "You have more faith in her than I do." Jules sets the butter and cream pitcher on the counter, so Kara can add it to the stock pot. She watches her aunt closely, but all she does is reach up into a cabinet for a sack of flour, maybe for biscuits. "You shouldn't have let her go." "Jules," Kara says, her voice sharp, "who am I to tell my sister what she can and cannot do, where she can and cannot go?" She starts to measure flour and lard. "Your Amelia is in a hurry. I wonder if that is how all warriors are, so eager to fight. Grandma Kate always said I had the worst temper she had ever seen." "So she did." They look at each other, remembering broken plates and screaming fits, wondering what could be attributed to the bound war gift and what was just a child needing to shout.
So, Jules says, what is this word you need to have with me?
She sweeps the chopped vegetables into her hand and adds them to the stew hanging over the fire, along with a measure of fish broth. But when she turns back, her aunt is frozen, staring blankly down at the knife on her cutting board.
Aunt Kara?
I don't know how to tell you this, Jules, so I am just going to tell you. There was a second prophecy after the Oracle saw your Legion curse that night. Kara straightens and looks into her eyes. After the Oracle saw your Legion curse, she told us to drown you, or to leave you out in the woods for the animals to find. That is just what is done when the curse is discovered. But Madrigal refused. She wailed, I wailed. The Oracle tried to take you out of your mother's arms, and when she did, she had another vision.
Another vision?
Different than the one before. Kara's brow knits. Her discovery of your Legion curse was like a healer finding a cracked bone, or a rider finding a swollen pastern on a horse. The second time was like a trance. She looks at Jules gravely. She said you would be the fall of the island. For a moment, Jules thinks she has misheard.
The fall of the island? Me?
She laughs.
That's ridiculous.
That's what she said.
Well, it must be a joke.
It could mean nothing. Prophecies mean a lot of things. Often never the things people think they do. Jules reaches for a potato and starts cutting it into chunks. The fall of the island. Her blade slows.
Or it has already come to pass. I was there when the ascension year failed, when the line of queens broke. I was there to help them escape. That must have been what the prophecy meant.
It must have been. And now you will lead an army against Catarine, who is despised by even the mist that protects us.
Yes,
Jules whispers. Unless you are wrong, says Kara, and the mist truly rises in response to you. Jules stops.
The prophecy must be wrong. The rebellion must be right. It must be. Because despite herself, it has won her heart and given her hope.
She peers out the window at Mathilde. Mathilde told me something back in Bastion City. She said that the oracle who saw my curse never returned. Kara adds more to the stew. Her mouth tightens.
Did Kate kill her?
Jules asks.
Did she kill her to keep her quiet?
Yes, Kara replies.
How?
The how doesn't matter any more than where we buried her. She will never be found. We offered to pay everything we had, but she wouldn't take it. Jules holds her knife tightly, so it will not begin to shake, so her war gift will not bury it up to the handle in the wall of the black cottage. She cannot look at her aunt. She cannot think of Kate. So much darkness around her birth. So much death.
You always told me how blessed I was.
You were. That was our crime, Jules, not yours. I never wanted to tell you. I didn't want you to bear it.
Someone always pays.
Kara and Juniper jump away from Mathilde, suddenly in the doorway.
Mathilde!
Jules exhales.
I nearly put this knife through your head!
The seer's eyes are empty. Juniper creeps close and sniffs her. She paws at her knee, then jumps up against the oracle's chest.
Oh!
Mathilde says and grasps the dog's shoulders.
Are you all right?
I am fine. Where is Amelia?
She's out hunting with Camden. Get her back. Get them both back. I have had a vision. We must call up the rebels now and fall back to Sunpool.
She pushes Juniper gently to the ground, and comes to take Jules by the wrists.
She knows. The queen knows. And she is coming.
How? How does she know?
She knows. Because she has your mother.
At sea.
How much farther? The captain asks.
Not far, Billy replies. But he sounds uncertain. They have sailed through the afternoon and into evening, and still there is no sign of the island.
Have we sailed for too long? Arsinoe asks. Is the mist not coming for us?
You would know better than I would, Mirabella replies. You have sailed into it much more than I have. And Billy would know best of all, having sailed into it and through many more times than either of them.
I thought you said this would be a few hours, the captain says. For what you paid, I've let it go on. But now we have to turn back.
A little farther. Arsinoe walks to the fore, leans out and over. I'll know it when I see it.
See what? There's nothing out here to see. No land in this direction until you run straight into Velostra.
Billy joins her and Mirabella by the railing.
I can't keep them out here much longer. We will have to turn and sail for home. Try again tomorrow.
Arsinoe grits her teeth. He's trying to sound regretful, but his tone is full of relief.
Look!
Mirabella lifts her hand and points. Though the horizon had been clear a moment ago, the mist stands up ahead, pale white from sea to sky. Under their feet, the little boat surges, and they hear the captain and his skeleton crew mutter in confusion.
A squall? We'll have to go around!
No! Arsinoe waves her arm forward. Straight through! Straight through! They plunge into the mist. It is so thick that Arsinoe cannot see Mirabella, though she is standing right beside her, and she is certain that if she breathes it in, it will stick inside her lungs and make her choke.
What's happening?
The captain shouts as inside the mist the wind dies.
Check the sails!
Mirabella and Billy grasp each of Arsinoe's hands.
This isn't like what it usually is, Billy whispers.
But nor is it like when they fled. The mist is thick and pure white. No thunder or rain, and the water so still that the boat barely bobs. But it is taking too long. Something large splashes just off to their port side, and Arsinoe shivers, imagining it is the Dark Queen taking form within the mist. In her ears, every wave is the slithering of the shadow's mermaid tail, coil after coil of it, rolling through the deep, murky water.
Where do you think it will take us? Mirabella asks.
For the mist can take them anywhere.
I never thought about it, Arsinoe admits.
I guess maybe I thought I'd pass through and be looking at Wolf Spring.
And I thought of Roland. When the truth is, we could emerge and find ourselves staring up at the twin spires of the Volroy.
Or, we could not emerge at all, Billy offers.
Arsinoe swallows. Everyone on board has fallen silent. Even the boat has ceased to creak.
Daphne, what have you lured me into?
There, Mirabella says. But the mist is too opaque to see where she points or whether she points at all.
Do you see that?
Arsinoe turns. She looks up and gasps. The Blue Queen is directly above them, a black shape that cuts through the white.
Has she always been there?
Billy murmurs as she raises her long, sinewy arms. And the mist dissipates. The three of them exhale and lean against the railing. They laugh with relief.
What in the world was that?
The captain asks. They did not see her. Mirabella looks up at the now empty sky. Good. If they had,
They'd have taken her for a witch and probably thrown us overboard. Look!
Arsinoe gestures ahead. Across the water lies the shores of what can only be Fenburn Island.
Where did that come from?
One of the fishers asks.
Never mind, says Billy. It's what we were looking for.
Arsinoe claps him on the back as he goes to make arrangements with the captain to get them ashore. Though they just sailed through the mist, they are already too close to identify what part of the island they have come upon. But it does not really matter. Daphne must have brought them here for a reason, and there are no black spires in sight. After speaking with the captain, Billy returns with a dubious expression.
Here's a complication. There are no small crafts or rowboats on board, and not a dock in sight. Do we pick a direction and sail to the nearest port, or...
No. With the island so close, Arsinoe cannot wait any longer. Have him take us as far into the shallows as he can, then we'll swim.
Arsinoe, it's freezing, and you have no idea how far we are from the nearest town.
So we'll start a fire. Billy sputters.
What about Mira? She can't swim in that corset and all those petticoats. She'll drown.
Actually, Mirabella says, staring over the side, I do not think I will drown. Arsinoe leans over. Her sister is shifting the current in small swirls that as she watches grow into contrary little waves. Mirabella turns and shouts to the captain,
Take us in as far as you can.
She looks at Arsinoe and Billy, her smile broad, the happiest Arsinoe has seen her in months. And you two, prepare for the easiest swim of your lives. Though the crew initially objects to Arsinoe and Mirabella swimming, they eventually bring the boat into the shallows. So far, in fact, that Arsinoe has to tell them to stop, for fear they will beach and have to come ashore themselves. As soon as they drop anchor, Mirabella dives over the side. Her splash brings the crew shouting and leaning over, too late to try and stop her.
Thank you, Captain, Arsinoe says and shakes his hand. I am truly grateful for your service, but now I had better get after my sister.
She steps up onto the rail and crouches.
Billy, don't forget the bags.
She jumps in, never that much of a swimmer, and her jaw instantly locks from the cold. Her arms and legs seize up as well, so she can barely grab for the satchel that Billy throws into the water. Another splash, and she hears him shout and curse her for such a stupid idea. But then Mirabella's current takes hold and ferries them toward shore.
Pretend to swim, she says, teeth chattering, or it'll look strange.
I'm too cold to even pretend, you arse, he says,
and a moment later their toes drag against the sand. Miserably freezing, they join Mirabella on the beach and wave to the slack-jawed fishers on the boat.
What must they think of what they found? Mirabella asks.
Doesn't matter, Arsinoe replies. They won't be able to find it again if they try. Not unless they're meant to. She turns and looks past the beach to the dense green moss and flat gray stone.
Good goddess! I've missed this terrible place.
Indrid Down Temple. With tired eyes, Peter cracks open yet another book from the many shelves of the temple library. He has been there since before dawn, after creeping out of Katarine's bed and onto the back of a cranky, half-awake horse, riding through the dark streets to slip into the library with a lamp and a sheaf of paper. Hours later, the paper is mostly blank. He has not come across much about the dead queens or even about exorcism, and when he does, he must be careful what he writes in case someone were to find the notes. He leans back and stretches, and the light of one of the small windows catches him in the eye.
He has no idea what time it is. It could be near midday. He bends over the book, scours a few pages, and shuts it again. Part of him wants to quit. It is not as though getting rid of the dead queens is something that Catherine wants, not when they have convinced her how much she needs them. But she does not need them. They forced her hand to take that young boy's life. Their existence is an affront to the goddess. It is their presence that has caused the mist to rise. It must be. If he does not find a way to stop them, they will cost Catherine everything. He takes the book back to its shelf. The library on the lower level of the temple is not large. The entirety of it could be fit into a corner of the one at Greavesdrake. But it is well stocked. The texts here are ancient and preserved nicely, not a speck of dust on the spines and no whiff of mold, even near the binding. Some of the pages actually smell rather like fresh parchment, simply from being so rarely read. He was sure he would find something here. But every tale of spiritual possession he has come across has been written about shallowly. Treatments simply alluded to, and sometimes the outcome not mentioned at all. Peter sighs, and gathers up his paper and fading lamp. Perhaps there is no way.
They said you have been here a long time.
He turns.
High Priestess, how do you manage to be so quiet with all those rustling robes?
Years of practice? What brings you to our library, Peter?
I did not know anyone saw me come in. What are you doing here?
The temple has been tasked with uncovering the truth of the mist.
She opens her hands and looks around at the shelves.
I came to learn of the progress.
Peter cocks an eyebrow. If there was progress made, there was none to be told of that morning. He had been the only person in the library since he arrived.
Are you also here on an errand for the queen?
Luca asks.
No. I am here on behalf of myself.
You know you can confide in me, Peter. She is as much my queen now as she is yours.
That is not true, he says and straightens. That will never be true.
All of our fates are tied to hers. You cannot keep her all to yourself. Not anymore.
She raises her arm and folds one side of him in soft white robes, squeezes his shoulder, and guides him back to the table where they sit. Perhaps it is because he is in need of sleep, or perhaps it is due to simple frustration. But after a moment, he says,
I am not here on behalf of Catherine. I have been looking into another solution to the mist.
He rubs his throbbing temples.
Examining any possibility. Sometimes I think I have found something useful, and then it falls apart.
It has been a long time since I took a deep dive into these old shelves.
Luca nods.
But I well remember how it felt. An aching back, dry eyes, so many words turning circles in my head.
Have you ever...
He starts and hesitates. Old Luca is shrewd. If he tells her what he seeks, all of Catherine's secrets about the dead queens may be laid bare. But it is true what she said. Her fate... The fate of the Black Council, the very tradition of the island, and their way of life are all tied to Catherine. So let Luca figure it out. Even if she were to know, she could do nothing.
In all your years, in service to the temple, he says, have you ever come across an instance of spiritual possession?
Spiritual possession? What an odd question.
Forgive me.
He waves his hand, casually.
I am exhausted. It was just something I happened upon this morning, and there was so little written about it. The entry was so vague.
I suppose it piqued my curiosity.
Luca drums her fingers on the table.
I have never seen a case of it. Only heard reports. None could ever be confirmed, which would explain the incomplete writings. The temple does not generally interfere in such things. The only thing for it is prayer, and usually a merciful execution.
Peter exhales. Merciful execution. That is a dead end, and a bleak one.
Of course, the High Priestess goes on. Knowing that, many sufferers do not seek the aid of the temple. They go elsewhere, to those who practice low magic.
Low magic is a desecration of the goddess's gifts.
They are desperate. Who knows? Sometimes it may work. Though the temple could never condone its use.
Low magic. It is not the answer he hoped for. To practice low magic is a danger even to those who are well versed in it. He knows nearly nothing of what it entails. Blast, he says, looking at his hand and seeing a smear of ink. Is it everywhere?
Just a bit on the cheek and the bridge of your nose.
Luca points and helps him to rub it off. What time is it?
Not yet midday.
Is the queen awake?
She was not when I left. Up too late celebrating. She is overjoyed to have the mother of Jeuyenne Malone locked up in the Volroy cells.
She pats him on the knee and stands.
You had best find some place to get some sleep. As soon as she rises, she will want to question the prisoner. And then, there will be decisions to make.
The Volroy. Catherine sits before her dressing table and rubs soothing oil into her temples and hands. For once, everything is proceeding as she hoped. The visions of the dead oracle Theodora Lermont proved true, and Catherine's soldiers found Jules's mother as she rode south through the mountains. She arrived the night before, arms tied behind her back and a sack over her head. Now she sits cozily in the cells below the castle.
A lovely morning, Catherine says to her maid Giselle.
It is, my queen.
Only the dark, blue expanse of the sea. No mist, no screams. No one running into the Volroy to tell me that more bodies have washed ashore. She takes a deep breath as Giselle gently brushes her hair.
How long has it been since we had any ill news?
Since before the oracle was brought?
Yes, since before the oracle was brought.
Since she has begun to pursue the legion-cursed pretender. The quiet mist must be a sign. She must be doing the right thing. Catherine reaches for a bottle of perfume and shoves away from the table so quickly that she knocks Giselle down onto the carpet.
Queen Catherine? What's the matter?
Catherine stares in horror at her right hand. It is dead, wrinkled and decaying to the wrist. She makes a fist and watches the skin stretch and crack.
Mistress? Giselle, my hand!
The maid takes it and turns it over.
I see no cut. Nothing to cause a sting.
She strokes Catherine's palm and presses her lips to it, those pretty red lips, to that wet, rotten skin.
There. Is that better?
Catherine tries to smile. The maid sees nothing. And indeed, when Catherine looks again, her hand is just her hand, pale and scarred, but alive as usual.
You still treat me as a child.
To me, you will always be a little bit a child.
Just the same, the queen says. I think I will finish up by myself. Would you go and see that my council is roused?
Giselle curtsies deep and leaves her alone. As much as she is ever alone.
What was that? She asks the dead queens. A warning? A mistake?
But though she can feel them listening, they do not respond.
Or was it a threat?
Catherine sits back down before her mirror, and with shaking fingers, lifts the styled black waves from her shoulders to tie with a length of ribbon.
Peter is right. After this battle is won, I will find a way to lay you to rest.
She slides her hands into black gloves.
Perhaps I truly will.
Before Catherine goes into the Volroy cells, she calls for Peter and Bree and the High Priestess. It takes them time to assemble, having been exhausted by revelry the night before. Peter is the last to arrive, and he does so looking wretched.
Such tired faces, she says as they lean against the wall. Perhaps I should go alone to see the Legion Queen's mother.
We are fine.
Luca straightens her shoulders.
Some of your council should be there for the questioning.
Very well. Try not to vomit in the corridor.
She turns and leads the way, relishing the cold rush of stale air closing over her head. She has always liked this part of the Volroy. From the first time that Natalia brought her there to help with the poisoning of prisoners, to the last time she descended, to show her sisters her crown. They reach the cell, and guards place extra torches to illuminate the straw-covered floor. Madrigal Malone sits with her back pressed to the rear wall. Or at least Catherine assumes it is Madrigal Malone. The guards have not taken the sack off her head. Beside her, another sack lies on the straw, with something inside flapping weakly. The naturalist's familiar, no doubt.
Go in, Catherine says. Remove the bag, both of them.
Jules's mother groans when the guard tears it away.
Now unbind her hands.
They do, and the prisoner rubs her wrists. They will need treatment. They have been rubbed raw to the point of bleeding. Finally, the guard dumps the last bag into the straw, and a crow tumbles out. Instead of flying, it hops on wobbly legs into the naturalist's lap.
You are indeed Madrigal Malone, says Catherine, leaning forward. Even under all that dirt, your pretty face is unmistakable.
Where am I?
In the cells beneath the Volroy, where your daughter was not long ago.
Catherine lets the woman ponder that as she blinks at her new surroundings, at the walls of dark, cool stone that collect dampness in the corners, and the wisps of stale straw on the floor. It is not the same cell that held Jules and her cougar. That one was many floors down. But it does not matter. Every cell in the Volroy holds an equal amount of terror and the same dank smell.
What am I doing here?
Asking too many questions, says Peter irritably.
Forgive him, Catherine says, as Peter studies the naturalist warily. He has a headache and got little sleep.
Madrigal does not respond. She continues to rub her wrists and stretch her fingers.
Will you not speak?
She jerks her head toward Peter.
He just said I was talking too much.
Why were you in the mountains? Catherine asks.
I was on an errand for my mother.
Your soldiers jumped me with no explanation.
She looks at Luca.
I thought I was being robbed. Or killed.
Catherine and Luca look at each other skeptically, and in the uncertain silence the crow hops out of Madrigal's lap to pace back and forth before the cell bars.
I think your bird would like to leave you, says Bree.
Of course she would. She's a survivor,
and she's never been much of a familiar.
Madrigal's eyes linger on the bars as well, and Catherine frowns. The mother is not like the daughter. Jules Malone is fierce. Too much loyalty and not enough brains. But Madrigal. Perhaps Madrigal could be used.
What can you tell me about your daughter, Zhewien?
Only what you already know.
That she's legion-cursed with naturalist and war. That she escaped with our...
She stops. With the other queens. And disappeared.
You have not seen her since? Peter asks.
No.
You think her dead, then?
Yes.
You are lying.
Katarine puts a hand on Peter's arm. What do you know about the Legion Queen?
I don't know anything about that, Madrigal says, with the barest hint of a smile.
We don't get much news in Wolfspring. I confess that, the day of the escape, I was the one who freed the bear. After Jules and the others sailed away into the storm, I brought him back north and released him into the woods there.
Hmm.
Katarine touches her chin with a gloved finger. The day of the escape was the last day I saw her too, down here in these cells, when I came to poison my sister Arsinoe to death, when I frightened them so badly that they chose to die at sea instead.
If you're convinced that my daughter is alive, then what makes you think the other queens aren't also?
Katarine's eyes glitter, and Madrigal recoils. The dead queens do not like her. They would stomp down hard on her pretty black bird and leave nothing but a red mess and feathers.
Tell me about the blood binding.
How do you know about that?
The same way we knew how to find you, says Katarine. We questioned someone. Unfortunately, that someone did not survive the questioning, so speak. If Jules is dead, like you say, then it will not matter.
Very well. Madrigal draws her knees up to her chest. We discovered Jules's curse when she was a baby, and I was told to drown her or leave her in the forest. But I couldn't. So I bound the Legion curse through low magic, bound it in my blood, to keep it from harming Jules and keep her from being found out.
But she was found out, says Katarine, and she is Legion cursed. It seems your low magic is not very strong.
Or Jules's gifts are so great that they overcame it.
Hmm, says Peter. You must truly want to die.
Katarine wraps her fingers around the bars. You know she is alive.
You were riding from the north, where her rebel army is. We have spies. We have seen.
If that's true, then why haven't you stopped her?
Katarine's hand slides down her side. She raises her boot and reaches for the small knives she always keeps there.
Madrigal crouches against the back wall.
Spill my blood, and the binding is broken. Whatever remains to hold my jewels in check will disappear. And if you're afraid of her now, wait until you see what she can really do.
I am a poisoner,
Katarine snaps, her hand drifting away from the knife.
I will poison you so your insides boil, but not a drop of blood will be lost. It will not be clean, but it will be contained.
That won't work either.
Murder by poison counts as blood spilled.
That's how it is with low magic.
Is that true? Bree asks. Or is she lying?
Madrigal smiles a pretty, crooked smile.
Maybe it is.
Or maybe I am. None of you know for sure. You exalted Arryns have had no cause to use low magic. And you, High Priestess, I know you would never touch it.
She is only trying to scare us, says Bree.
Is it working? Madrigal asks. Are you willing to chance it? I have been using low magic all my life. I know its ways as well as its ways can be known.
Katarine grits her teeth. She is not sure yet. For now, let the woman remain locked up in the dark cells. Quietly, she turns on her heel and leads the others back above ground.
Well, she says, you are my advisors.
So what do you advise?
Bree crosses her arms and speaks hesitantly.
We should learn what we can about the low magic binding. Send for experts, if any will come forward.
None will, says Katarine. And if they do, none will know more than the Malone woman knows herself.
High Priestess, what do you think?
Luca takes a deep breath.
Ro has been assessing the Queen's Guard. There are near 5,000 trained soldiers in and around the capital, and another 1,000 standing at Prin. More are waiting to be called up and trained. You have what you need to crush a rebellion, even one supported by a lesser number of war-gifted and oracles. But that is not what I think you should do.
Am I to wait, then, for Spring and the Naturalist to march on the capital?
You have her mother, Lucas says. I think you should arrange a trade. Without Jules Malone, the rebellion will fold.
Katarine stares at the High Priestess as she considers. She would avoid a battle if she could, even though the dead queens clamor for it, to stand directly in the midst of it with blood on her arms, in her teeth.
I could not execute her. That would only entrench the rebels further. I would have to hold Jules Malone here, under charge of treason, and then offer a sentence of mercy.
Her eyes narrow.
Would she truly trade the rebellion for her mother?
It is worth a try. And I know Kate Malone. If you hand down a sentence of mercy, she will accept it. And Wolfspring will take its cue from her. What does the goddess say? Do you feel her hand in this?
Katarine cocks her head.
Should I not be asking you that?
You are the goddess on earth, Queen Katarine. I am only her voice to the people.
At her words, the dead queens twist through Katarine's insides, spreading the ash gray of corpses through her body until she can practically taste it.
I have never felt the goddess, says Katarine. She turned her back on me, so I have acted in kind. Is that why the mist rises? Because a queen sits the throne who will not kneel?
The goddess does not demand your loyalty. She does not need it any more than she needs our understanding.
Curse the Blue Queen, Katarine mutters under her breath. If not for the mist, the people would not be so desperate. What went so right for her that she was able to perform such a feat?
It was not what went right, Luca says, but what went wrong. Queen Ilion created the mist to protect the island from an invasion, a spurned suitor who returned to wage a war. Have you never studied the murals of the queens in our temples? A queen can do great things when she must.
Katarine sighs and turns to Peter, who nods. She will ride north, then, and make the trade, if the cursed naturalist will agree to it. Sunpool. Arsinoe, Mirabella, and Billy navigate the sloping, mossy cliffs of the coastline, trying to reach high ground. Arsinoe, in her hurry, slips and knocks her knee against exposed rock. But she is not the one in the lead. Mirabella has nearly crested the hill. She has pulled her hair free of its pins, and Arsinoe suspects that she has called a little of the wind that whips through it. She has never seen anyone look so triumphant, even in a muddy, blue, saltwater-stained mainlander dress.
I thought she said it would take some time for her gift to return, says Billy breathlessly. But she could move the water the moment we arrived.
Well, you know Mira, always the pessimist.
Mirabella's current made their swim to shore so easy that they each have energy to spare for the walk. and after they reached land, she conjured a blazing fire so they would be warm and dry while they did it.
"Do you know where we are?"
Billy asks, and adjusts his pack on his shoulder. Arsinoe looks inland, upward. The behemoth of Mount Horn sits to the east, not terribly far. We're west of the mountains, away from Wolf Spring, away from Rolanth, a whole island between us and our baby sister. It is probably the best place for Daphne to bring them, secluded and secret, where they will not likely be seen.
And we have to climb that?
He nods to the peak.
Not all the way, I hope.
I hope not either. She hurries ahead to where Mirabella has stopped at the top of the hill.
Look, Mirabella says. Is that what I think it is?
Across the rolling hills lies the white-walled city of Sunpool, the Oracle's city.
Why would the mist bring us here? Mirabella asks. I do not like the idea of being so close to so many seers.
Nor do I, Arsinoe says distractedly. But I have always wanted to see Sunpool. And this is a very fine view of it. The sprawling white castle and the built-up wall. White buildings nestled so tightly together that the whole of it looks like a cluster of sea-bleached coral. They say when the sunset strikes, the city appears to burn, though there is no evidence of that on a day as cold and gray as this. Billy catches up and peers at it.
What did that used to be?
Sunpool, the city of oracles, Mirabella replies. And it used to be grand, Arsinoe adds, before the gift weakened and the numbers dwindled, before the people started to fear the sight as near a curse. In reality, the once proud white walls are crumbling, chunks of stone rolled away to wear down to roundness and be covered with moss. The central castle, though still sprawling, is covered in vine and the dirt of centuries. But it is still easy to see what it was. The seers are weak and few, says Arsinoe. I think we're safe enough, even close as we are. Probably the perfect place to buy supplies and a hot meal. A forgotten city for a secret quest. Billy reaches for coin in his pocket. He takes his pack off his shoulder and considers the goods inside.
Maybe I should go alone and get what we need. You two are still a little too recognizable, even in those colorful clothes.
Agreed, says Arsinoe, as Mirabella reluctantly drapes a gray scarf over her hair. They walk toward the city, stopping at the crest of every hill to make sure to avoid main roads. Arsinoe and Mirabella fall into easy chatter, so that Billy has to tug on their arms when he notices something odd.
Didn't you say this place was deserted?
Not many live here anymore, that's true.
Well, that doesn't look deserted to me.
He points to Sunpool, and Arsinoe and Mirabella shield their hands from imagined brightness, as if that were responsible for what they see. Hundreds of people crowd the streets. Disorganized, harried-looking people, pushing handcarts and carrying packs of supplies.
Is it a marketplace? Arsinoe asks.
Mirabella points to the east.
Look, on the roads, more are coming.
It is not a steady stream, but it seems an uncommon number for a city not known to have a large share of visitors. As they watch, someone releases a messenger bird from one of the castle's uppermost windows. That bird is flying awfully fast, says Arsinoe, and awfully straight. What is a naturalist doing in Sunpool? She tugs Billy around and rummages through his pack for another scarf. This one to wrap around her scarred face and mouth. He looks at her doubtfully.
I know there's a chill in the air, but that still looks unseasonable.
Maybe I have a cough. She tugs the scarf up over the tip of her nose. Curiosity has gotten the better of her,
She cannot be left outside the city now.
Let's go in and see what's happening.
Inside, they find a hive of activity. Mirabella and Arsinoe are careful to keep their hair and faces partially obscured, but there is little need. The constant flow of new arrivals means strangers are aplenty, and everyone is on the way to this place or that. No one looks at each other for very long.
Should I go try to find out what's happening? Billy asks.
Mirabella takes him by the arm.
No, that will only draw attention to you. Just keep moving and listening.
They make their way through the wide main road. Only a few people seem to know Sunpool well enough to provide direction, and many of them are dressed in gray and yellow. Oracle colors. Mirabella carefully maneuvers them away from every gray or yellow cloak they see, until Arsinoe's ears prick at the mention of Wolf Spring.
They're running grain stores up the coast. Should be here any day.
But no fighters?
A few have come on their own, less than I'd expected. Maybe she'll bring them with her when she arrives.
Fighters. Grain stores. And everyone through the gates seems armed, or armed after a fashion with clubs and shovels. Mirabella taps her on the shoulder and ducks into a tavern. Arsinoe pulls Billy in after her.
We have stumbled into an army camp, Mirabella whispers furiously as she leads them to the rear. I am less and less certain of your Daphne bringing you here for a simple solitary quest. It changes nothing. I'm still headed up that mountain as soon as I have the food and clothes to make it.
Thinking of food, her stomach growls. There are bowls of stew on many of the tables, and cups of wine and ale, loaves of golden, soft-looking bread.
I'll go and get us some, Billy says, following her eyes. We can eat standing up, and then go back out and try to barter, though I don't know how much luck we'll have.
He slides through the tables to the bar. There is nowhere to sit, hardly anywhere to stand. And without Billy, Arsinoe and Mirabella huddle together, two black-haired girls in mainland clothes and no shadow large enough to hide in. It seems forever until he returns, carrying bowls of stew and trying not to spill, one fat chunk of bread floating in each. They eat in silence, eyes on their food. Mirabella with her head bowed. Arsinoe sneaks bites in between lowering and raising the scarf that covers her nose. They are nearly finished when people start to hurry past the tavern windows.
What's happening?
Arsinoe asks, as the door flies open and the inside of the pub begins to rapidly empty. Billy runs out of patience and grabs a man by the shoulder.
Oi, what's happening? Where's everyone going?
She's here. I think she's here!
The fellow points to the street and runs after the crowd.
She?
Mirabella and Arsinoe lock eyes.
She.
The queen? They set their bowls onto the nearest empty table and go to the window. So many have crowded around the tavern that seeing is impossible. Frustrated, Arsinoe turns to the barkeep.
Plenty of coin, if you'll permit us to your upstairs windows.
She nudges Billy, who gets it out of his pockets.
As you like, the barkeep replies. She chuckles a little as she wipes out a cup. Though if it really is the Legion Queen, you'll have plenty more chances to get a view.
She jerks her head over her shoulder, through to the kitchen. They hurry, running quickly past the near-empty pot of stew and up the flight of stairs to the woman's private room.
The Legion Queen, Arsinoe mutters.
Who?
A thought flashes into her mind. But that is impossible. It can't be.
Mirabella reaches the window first. It is not that high, but the view is substantially better than the one from below. The gate of the city is open, and the first riders are coming through.
Riders only, no carriage, and no black. It cannot be an Aran caravan.
Arsinoe presses her nose to the cold, dusty glass. There is no black at all.
Not even the horses.
Then she sees the mountain cat, curled onto the rump of a large bay workhorse. Her dark tail tip twitches, and she nervously swats with her good paw